This is Our Common Ground with Janice Graham, transforming truth to power, one broadcast at a time.
At reparations, as in reparatory justice, including restitution and cash payments, is absolutely necessary to address the racial wealth gap, but also the moral recognition gap of slavery, neo-slavery, and the ongoing effects of America's past in the present. Human chattel, capital, as in enslaved Africans, essentially laid the foundation for America to become an economic superpower. In the midst of all that we are going through, we have the moral capacity, we have the economic capacity, we have the civic capacity as a country in the midst of this racial reckoning to address the past perpetuating in the present and that may well haunt us in the future unless we issue checks, unless we engage in restitution, and most importantly, unless we recognize the harm that we visited upon Black folks in a way that really brings together the whole of the country.
Tonight at Our Common Ground, we're proud to begin our one-month series, Reparations, the Debt That Is Owed. Tonight, Episode 1, The Debt That Is Owed, Reparations, and the Descendants of U.S. Chattel Slavery. Joining us in this first episode of this four-part series, Dr. William Sandy Darity joins us once again, and A. Kirsten Mullen. They are co-authors of From Here to Eternity, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century.
America's chickens coming home.
You're gonna sing the swim, you're gonna learn the truth. No matter what you do, you're gonna learn the truth.
Alternative activists, empowerment, talk radio, speaking truth to power and ourselves.
Passes a three-strike law and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God.
Our Common Ground with Janice Graham.
Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves. Our Common Ground, a higher ground for discourse, discussion, solutions, and ideas.
I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you.
Talk, talk, that matters.
You just don't give up, just don't give up.
And now, Janice Graham.
And good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us here at Our Common Ground, the Black Truth Sanctuary, where we honor not only what is important to us, who has been important to us, but we honor the language in which we hold all of those things. If you are looking to get into our chat room, you can come to blogtalkradio.com/OCG. Tonight we begin the Our Common Ground series, Reparations, the Debt That Is Owed. In this first episode, we have with us Dr. Sandy Darity, Dr. William A. Darity Jr., and Kirsten Mullen, the co-authors of the book that I have been asking you to read for over a month to prepare for this series. And the book is the most important publication available to you to understand exactly
what debt is owed. So we hope that you did. If not, you will just have to catch up. The book is From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And it is my pleasure to have joining us once again Dr. Sandy Darity. Thank you so much for being with us once again.
Thank you for having me.
Each time you come to this show, I have something special for you. And here it is. We're going to take a minute to welcome you back because we are so excited about the progress that you have made since the last time we have talked on this subject. You know I always have to bring you some harmonica blues.
Yes.
So,
thank you.
And as
I just
we
want
get
to say,
started.
I'm here with Kirsten Mullen. So
Kirsten,
whenever you
welcome
want both
to
of
our
us
common
to come
ground.
In.
We're
so pleased to have both of you. And we're honored to have both of you. And people, you need to realize that you're about to listen to treasure right here on Our Common Ground tonight, because getting these two together here is just an important venture in our understanding of one of the most fierce issues before us as a people. Sandy, let me just say that since the last time you were here, you have not only moved mountains, you have built mountains. And I am so grateful. I am one of those 60s hippies that in 1968 pressed myself into the reparations discourse and movement, anyone that I could find. And I look at what you have been able to achieve over the last 5 years, and it has been monumental, especially with culminating last year with the book, the kind of research that you have done, the kind of capacity that you have created for our people to begin to understand. Because the last time you were here, you know, one of the things that I always talk about, and I still talk about it, is the vacuum of information, education, and understanding on the issue of reparations, and why I am always hailing the idea that there is a debt owed. So thank you so very much, both of you.
That was quite generous. I just wanted to say that I think for both of us, more often it feels like we're pushing against a mountain than necessarily building one.
Well, imagine that I came away from the Gary Convention really never having had anyone speak to the issues of the history that I learned as a student in the Jim Crow South. I have been asked over and over in the last maybe week and a half how I learned about the Tulsa Massacre. And because I had black teachers and I was in a segregated school system, we learned about the Tulsa Massacre in the fifth grade. It was a subject of American history, U.S. history. And also the community, which you talk about it a lot, you and Kirsten talk about it a lot, and I think people don't get it, that in addition to Tulsa, Rosewood, Wilmington, there were many other communities that were prosperous, that was devastated by racial violence.
And I grew up in one of those, and it is a history that even to today, even in Black History, February 2021, people in Palm Beach County continue to try to deny and call it folklore. So, and it's really interesting. I'm very interested in talking with Kirsten because she's a student and scholar, lecturer on the issues of, she's a writer and a folklorist, and they are still calling the Styx massacre a folklore in the local newspapers. So we can talk about that. But when I say that you have built a mountain, what I am referencing is the vast and very deep and factual crater in which we can now discuss reparations.
Yeah, I mean, I think we absolutely have been working hard to build on, the research, the shared stories from our ancestors, really. And, I'm very interested to hear a bit more about your experience, in Palm Beach County. But, starting with Tulsa, we have been saying how incredible it has been to hear President Biden confirm that the massacre did take place and to let Americans know that it was incredibly destructive, that it took place over several days. And to say, yes, lives were lost. Many, many people were injured. Black Americans' personal property was destroyed and then confiscated and appropriated by the very, the very white mobsters who had inflicted this violence upon them. I mean, to the best of our knowledge, he's the first and only American president who has acknowledged this fact. And that's something that I think is really, really important. Especially, in this era when, as you say, people's lived experience is being denied, rendered, rendered fiction. So I think certainly in many Black families, these stories have been shared, but, many folks did not have exposure to these stories. I mean, we came to North Carolina as adults, but our children were educated in the public schools, and they were not taught about the Wilmington, North Carolina massacre of 1898. It's been only in maybe the last two decades, actually, that story has been told. And initially folks were saying, oh, this is the only coup d'etat that happened in the United States. Well, that's not true at all. There have been a number of cases where white Americans sought to either thwart Blacks from going to the polls to vote on during the period of Reconstruction to vote on fellow Republicans, they were determined to overturn a duly elected Black and white electoral body. They didn't care for the results of the election, and so decided that they would either run out of town or murder the Black Republicans who had been elected. We were looking at Fort Bend County, Texas, where the Jaybird and Woodpecker War took place in 1888 and 89. And this was exactly the case there. The white Democrats decided that they were not going to stand for this biracial group of folks who'd been elected and, proceeded to attack them. Several hundred people were killed. And then for the next 70 years, the Democrats held sway in political circles in Fort Bend County. Some 441 white men signed the White Man's Declaration of Independence, and they were very clear, very adamant about how they thought things should how governance should take place in Fort Bend County, Texas.
Yeah, and we are convinced that the sentiments that are associated with these types of massacres, which included the overturning of duly elected governments in a number of towns and cities, that's the same sentiment that informed the events of January 6th of this year.
Mm-hmm. What is so wonderful and important about your book, From Here to Equality, is that the central and core theme helps us to see the sustained American failure to recognize the pernicious impact of white supremacy and the sustained American failure to adopt national policies that would reverse the effects of white supremacy, and that at each point that the nation has stood at some revolving or some crossroad with respect to its racial future, it has chosen the wrong path. That's
exactly.
I think that is what comes from the book that is so important. But let's for a minute, and I do have a clip, and I'd like to talk about when we talk about reparations in 2021, what are we talking about? And I specifically am asking our audience to listen very carefully, because there's a lot of fallacious discussion and discourse going on within the community that serves as an impediment. So here is A. Kirsten Mullen talking about what we are talking about when we say reparation pays the debt and what reparations is, and we're going to come back and talk to Dr. Sandy Darity and A. Kirsten Mullen about it.
Reparations are a program of acknowledgement, redress, and closure for grievous injustice. Where African Americans are concerned, the grievous injustices that make the case for reparations include slavery, legal segregation, or Jim Crow, and ongoing discrimination and stigmatization. ARC, A-R-C, the acronym that stands for Acknowledgement, Redress, and Closure, characterizes the three essential elements of the reparations program that we are advocating. Acknowledgement.
Kirsten, can you embellish on the three parts that encompass what we mean when we say reparations, the ARC?
Yes, happily. As we're saying, acknowledgement is this moment when the perpetrators of the harms, sit down and talk about, all the ways that they benefited from those actions. And they, work with African Americans to figure out what will it take to make amends. And it's not solely a case of an apology. It's also a commitment to redress, a commitment to restitution, a commitment to some form of tangible compensation that will, lead to, Black Americans, enjoying a greater sense of well-being and having an opportunity to participate more fully in American life. I mean, we're talking about, the moment when Black Americans step into full citizenship rights in this country, which has yet to happen.
And then there's redress.
Following that too would be, redress and closure. So redress, as we say, can take multiple forms. We're talking about atonement or restitution, but, you can't restore the enslaved people to a period of, they're not having been enslaved. I mean, those people are long gone, and in fact, many of the, Black people who were enslaved in this country were born enslaved, and so never knew a different kind of life, so they can't be restored to a condition of, that preceded their enslavement. But it is possible to, you know, to focus on their descendants and to make it possible for them to attain, to attain a place, to get to a place where, you know, it's as if the injustice had not taken place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we focus on restitution and not on atonement. And we can sort of talk about atonement acts and racial equity issues, you know, perhaps a later part in the program, but we're focusing on redress. And then we also talk about closure. Closure involves kind of a reconciliation, a mutual reconciliation between Black Americans and the folks who benefited from slavery, from legal segregation and ongoing discrimination toward Black Americans. And this is the moment when, you know, Blacks and whites would, you know, basically, you know, come to terms about the past, confront the present, and decide that going forward, you know, we will have this new transformed United States, but one in which these harms are not, recommitted. We don't have a revisiting of these harms, and no new harms are committed against Black people. And once that point is reached, then there would be no further claims that Black people would make, on the federal government. But basically, you know, we're talking about, you know, restitution that would eliminate racial disparities in wealth, in income, in education, health, sentencing and incarceration, political participation, you know, basically, you know, creating a very different kind of world for Black Americans when you're looking at both the political and the social landscape.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about – go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that we tend to emphasize wealth as the target for a reparations plan because we view wealth, which we distinguish from income, and this is very important, where wealth is the net value of your personal property and is something that you can utilize in the instances where your income, which is predominantly driven by your earnings, when your income falls or when your income is lost. If you are a wealthier individual, you have a cushion against that loss. And we think that the difference in wealth between Blacks and whites is the best indicator, the best economic indicator of the cumulative intergenerational effects of white supremacy. And so so we place a focus on elimination of the racial wealth gap as a priority for a reparations plan. In addition to that, we specify that the individuals who should receive reparations are Black Americans who have ancestors who were enslaved in the United States. And the rationale for that specificity is because that's the community of individuals whose ancestors were denied the 40-acre land grants that they were promised in the aftermath of the Civil War. So that's where we get the foundation for the debt that you're talking about. It is indeed a debt that has not been paid for 156 years. And then a final point that we make is that the form that redress should take is direct payments to the individual recipients. Just as redress has taken that form, in other instances where victimized communities have received reparative justice. Important examples would include the German government's payments to victims of the Holocaust. In the United States, we have an excellent model for reparations for Black Americans in the form of the payments that were made to Japanese Americans who were unjustly incarcerated during World War II. So it's been done. We know how to do it. It's time to do it.
Yeah. You know, again, as you said earlier, you were talking about the crossroads, you know, all of these moments in our nation's history when the federal government could have made a different decision and had, and consequently, created a very different kind of life for Black people. The nation, the republic could have been founded as a slave free nation, but it wasn't. You know, so that was one very significant crossroad. And then the decision to deny the recently emancipated, you know, formerly enslaved people, these 40-acre land grants. Now, we know at the same time, beginning in 1862, the federal government created a Homestead Act, which made 160-acre parcels of land available to white Americans, including recent immigrants from Europe. So this was an opportunity for, you know, them to take possession of, you know, this property at, you know, below market rates. And if they improved the land, you know, they basically had no expense. You know, no payments were made to the federal government. This was a tax-free, basically gift from the federal government. You know, they were being settled in the western part, the western territory of the United States. So this was actually, you know, the way that the United States completed its settler colonial project, you know, because these are lands that had just recently been occupied by Native American people, that they were settling these white Americans through the Homestead Acts. Now, the 40-acre land grants that black Americans were promised and then denied was a land that was stretching from the South Sea Islands of South Carolina across you know, the base of the country to the St. John's River, the mouth of the St. John's River in Florida. These were lands that had recently been confiscated from and abandoned by the Confederates. So somewhat different you know, kind of circumstances here. But you have white Americans being allowed to receive these 160-acre land grants, and black Americans promised and denied 40. So even if, you know, so we're starting out with a 4-to-1 discrepancy, and then the black you know, the black emancipated folks were denied even those 40 acres. But we know that something of like 250 million acres of land was given under the Homestead Act, which is a huge amount of land. I mean, that's a land mass equivalent to, you know, all of California and Texas combined. And, you know, so 1.5 million white families were the recipients of these Homestead Acts, and that translates to about 45 million white households today that are still reaping the benefits of this single federal program. I mean, it's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. You know, we have seen, you know, situations where, you know, they have been able to. So, you know, I was going to say, when you think about what one could do with this land. You know, this is property that you could live on yourself. If there's lumber on the land, if there are minerals on the land, if there's you know, wildlife that's yours to use or to sell, you could subdivide it, you could lease it, you could you know, use it as collateral for a loan, for a business you know, venture. You could use the money, you know, to send your kids to college so they emerge debt-free. But these 45 million individuals, you know, not households, but 45 million individuals today have, it's almost like they're receiving a, you know, a monthly dividend check from the federal government. You know, one of our colleagues, Jennifer Mueller, with one of her classes, asked the students to, you know, investigate their family's wealth position. And the class of about 150 students, 100 of whom were white, 12 or 13 of the students were black, and the rest were of color. And, you know, the students are extremely skeptical about what they might find. But, in fact, over a third of the white students discovered a land grant, you know, patent in their family. And none of the black students and none of the students of color had any, you know, learned of any evidence of a land grant in their families. And then in one extraordinary case, this was a family that had received a land grant in 1880 in the Texas Panhandle area. And eventually there were 8 children. Then after the father, who had received the patent, died, his widow decides to move with their 8 children to Austin, Texas, to increase the likelihood that the kids could go to college. six of the eight received college degrees, and then after, and they've been leasing the land up to this point, so receiving, you know, receiving revenue from the property. Then after their mother dies, the eight children decide to continue to lease the land and divide the profits eight ways. Then in 1980, a full 100 years after the land grant had been made, natural gas is discovered on the property. And in that first year alone, the revenue from that natural gas deposit was over $100,000. So it's just these are the kinds of stories that we're learning white Americans have in their past, but many of them are not aware of it. You know, many of the, mm-hmm. Today's families are not aware of this. And we had said, gosh, you would think that these would be the kinds of stories that would be, you know, lovingly shared and told over and over and over every time the family came together. But in fact, for many of these families, the evidence of these land grants and of the government assistance that their family received and in many cases continue to receive, this asset building, that they have received from the federal government is not part of the family stories. It's almost been erased from their stories, even as they are reaping the benefits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because they don't want to be known as welfare queens.
Well,
there are families who are quite clear about
these are the original government handouts.
It was a government handout, basically.
That's with the white people.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, we would say that we don't begrudge them these government mm-hmm. Support, but it simply should have gone to everyone. Everyone should have
but
had
there's another way, Kirsten and Sandy, that where those stories are important to be told in the narrative of American history, and especially in our black collective, and that is that in telling those stories, people feel less fearful, or I wouldn't say fearful, less reluctant about claiming a position of demanding reparations for black people.
Yes.
That black people would be more confident and understand that this is nothing new. This
right.
restitution is nothing new for this government. Let's talk about, I'm always trying to help my audience be less fearful and more confident about this demand for reparations. I attended two or three sessions of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa as an observer. And looking at those in terms of making corporate decisions recommendations to an international company. But would truth and reconciliation, a process of truth and reconciliation, be part of the plan as you see it?
Can you talk about Barbara?
Congressperson Barbara Lee, gotta get the gender timber right these days. Barbara Lee has a proposal for a truth commission, which we think is actually a very good idea, especially given the fact that people knew so little about massacres like the one that took place in Tulsa and have no sense of the fact that there were actually 100 of these or so that took place between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that there could be a tremendous value in a commission that has the responsibility for truth-telling. We're less confident about the notion of reconciliation. And in fact, in Barbara Lee's proposal, she doesn't actually use the term reconciliation. The reason we have some reservations about that, although we sometimes use the term ourselves, is because of the prefix rec, we have not had a previous period of racial conciliation to reconcile ourselves towards. So it would be an act of reparations that would be the foundation for having the first round of conciliation. So we think a truth commission is a good idea. The South African case is a bit troublesome, though, and I'll ask Kirsten to talk about this a bit more.
Let me just say this. I'm thinking of it in two parts, the truth before the reparations and the reconciliation part of it possibly coming after the disbursement of whatever policy comes down. And I'm glad that you mentioned Congresswoman Lee's proposal, because that gets lost in it. But Kirsten, I know that you have done a lot of work, and you do discuss in great detail the notion of what a truth commission does and the history of how sometimes they fail. I know in South Africa the reconciliation thing has never really happened.
Yeah, this is true. I think part of the difficulty with the South African case was that they set up this dichotomy, you know, that purported that the two sides were, quote, equal. You know, that they both had, what is it, good people on both sides, you know, which was absolutely not the case. And this is not what I think many of the black South Africans thought the process was going to be about. And I think many of them felt misled by it. And also that the administrators were all too quick to say, well, anyone who, you know, comes forth and describes the atrocities that they were part of will be pardoned. You know, so there was not this holding these individuals to account. There were no consequences in this case. But then the other part of it too is they were not focusing on the all of the ways that the black Africans had been oppressed by this regime. And so there was no focus on what their financial situation looked like, what was the racial wealth gap looking like, or any remedies to that. So, gathering information in and of itself is not sufficient. You know, yes, it's really important to, creating the public record, I think, is really important, you know, both for individuals to, to kind of come together and crystallize their own thinking about what's happened. I think that's really, really important. These commissions can serve as a mechanism for uniting communities behind the idea of redress. They can also serve as a way to a way for organizations that, you know, may have had a purpose that was similar to reparations or redress, but not their focus, decide that this is something they want to commit their resources to.
It's really interesting that we're having this conversation in the same space of time where we have a government who's refusing to even do a truth commission or an investigation around a riotous attack on our capital and our government. And
exactly.
You have to wonder, in this country that is so immature, whether or not it is going to be diluted. And one of the things that I see, Kirsten, is that the Truth Commission and the Lee proposal is really a way in which to dilute the import of this entire undertaking and demand. I think in the immaturity and the brand of white supremacy in the U.S. that everybody is always, especially the political elite, And the capitalists are always looking at a way of how can we soften this? How can we minimize the output, the end product of this? And it's and it makes you very, very anxious about how we are going to approach this, which brings me to my question about payments. And I mean, there are even within our own collective, I'm reluctant to call it a community anymore because of the significant import and impact of gentrification and the divisiveness in which we approach anything that is focused to address racial injustice. We get so divided. So I'm calling it the Black Collective, that people are reluctant to grasp the concept of how payments would work under a reparations plan. So I want to ask you both two questions and ask you to address it. And that is, what is your vision as the expert? And the other is, how does H.R. 40 begin to address payments?
So we're going to do a tag team on this one. So the,
okay.
The first thing I wanted to say was that I think it's really important in these you know, these hearing processes to create a space for the stories of the harms to become part of the public record. I mean, I think that's really, really important. And this is one of the things that was really vital in the work that the Japanese redress movement, caused to happen. This is the work of the Commission on Wartime Relocation of Internment of Civilians. But also, you know, their process forced the federal government to have to say why it did what it did and to try to justify its actions. And so that, you know, is another important piece of, you know, this kind of the inquiry process, you know, the investigative process, is to have all of these different groups that had, an investment in this question of black people's history and how black people have been treated in the United States, have them go on record talking both about the harms and then, you know, the attempts of federal government to try to justify the work that they did. But you wanted to talk about the sort of the Black Collective and, how our vision, we hope, is, you know, continuing to shape this conversation about, you know, what payments would look like and where they would come from, but also, and then we'll segue to talk a bit about H.R. 40.
Yeah, I was going to say that the value of a truth commission, in part, if it generates an accurate and detailed report, is that it can facilitate providing additional support, popular support, for the reparations effort. And I think that was one of the significant dimensions of what what was accomplished in the context of the Japanese American case, where the report that was generated indicated that there was no evidence that was present at the time when the internment took place that Japanese Americans were a security threat to the nation. But they were still incarcerated anyway. And that made it crystal clear that there was a case for compensation or restitution. And so I think that's a potential benefit of a truth commission is you can further build the case for restitution or compensation by providing detailed evidence of the array of atrocities that have taken place in the United States directed against black people, particularly black people whose ancestors were enslaved in the United States. We know from a study that was conducted in 2000, a survey that was taken in 2000, that at that point, only 4% of white Americans endorsed reparations for black Americans. By the year 2018, that percentage had risen to about 16. Still relatively low, but considerably larger than 4%. And then the most recent polls that we've seen that were taken this year suggest that the proportion is closer to 30% now. So that's a movement in the right direction. And I think if we were going to sustain that movement to create greater support for reparations, it would be valuable to have a detailed official report that established what the scope is of the harms and damages that have been inflicted upon Black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
So what is now the status in front of our government of H.R. 40, and what are the flaws that you have identified in this bill? And, of course, people in the audience would be very interested in understanding the potential of that bill becoming real.
Okay. So there are two different things. There's this Truth and Reconciliation, or actually it's not the full title, it's called the Truth and Healing Commission that Representative Barbara Lee has proposed. And then there's a separate thing, H.R. 40, which calls for a study commission to look at the question of reparations for Black Americans and to provide recommendations, right, to Congress. So we are in that that interesting position of being, ardent supporters of the Truth and Healing Commission proposal of Representative Lee's, but we do not support H.R. 40 at all in its current form.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that we feel that it has both structural problems, but also just in the way that the commission has been reworked in the, in 2021, provide a lot of problems for us. So there are basically four major kind of omissions of H.R. 40 that we would like to point out. The first is it does not identify the eligible recipients. And as Sandy mentioned earlier, for us, these are Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. These are descendants of the folks who were promised those 40-acre land grants and denied them, people who were denied the opportunity to profit from those 40 acres and to pass those profits down across generations to their offspring. As white Americans were able to do through the Homestead Act, a program that created wealth that is still very much part of the reality of 45 million white individuals today. But not the case for Black people because they didn't have, they absolutely didn't have 160 acres. They didn't have 40 acres to pass down. All right. So two-part eligibility criteria. The first is the lineage criteria, individuals who can prove that they are descended from at least one person who was enslaved in the United States. And the second, individuals who 12 years prior to the creation of a reparations program or the impaneling of Reparations Commission self-identified as Black, African-American, Afro-American, or Negro. So that's the first piece. H.R. 40 needs to specify who's eligible for reparations. Second, H.R. 40 does not identify the elimination of the racial wealth gap as one of its primary goals. And we know that today that gap is approximately $840,000 per household. You're looking at, on the low end, $11 trillion to eliminate that racial wealth gap, and that needs to be part of H.R. 40. The legislation does not indicate that payments should be made directly to the eligible recipients. And as Sandy mentioned earlier, this is absolutely the case in the Golden Standard, reparations programs in the U.S. and abroad. He referenced the Holocaust victims who Germany paid and is paying direct restitution today. Also, the U.S. government, which wasn't even a perpetrator in that case, is paying reparations to American citizens who were harmed by the Holocaust. And again, you mentioned the case of Japanese Americans who received uniform payments of redress from the federal government. And then fourthly, H.R. 40 does not designate the culpable party. We've been talking about these federal policies, starting with, legalizing slavery itself, that advantaged white Americans and disadvantaged black Americans. This is why the federal government must pay the bill. The other reason is the federal government is the only entity that can pay the bill. $11 trillion is not a trivial amount of money. We hear a lot about local and statewide initiatives for quote-unquote reparations. The Evanston, Illinois Housing Voucher Program is one such program. Asheville, North Carolina, near where we are, passed some legislation actually for minority set-asides. Austin, Texas is trying to do some work regarding its housing program. Burlington, Vermont, the state of California, there's a handful of these that are popping up.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, all of these are what we would call racial equity initiatives and not reparations. And we think it's confusing at best and harmful at worst. We don't think that these initiatives are an on-ramp to reparations. We think that they are a distraction, that people will say, well, you've got all these other programs. Why do you need a national program?
Yeah. Intentionally marginalizing the issue of reparations for chattel slavery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In many cases, the programs that these local initiatives are attempting to address, like in the Evanston case, Austin, and so many others, at the heart of these cases is redlining, and redlining was a national initiative. So, this clearly points to the need for a national solution. But the other thing, too, when you look at the budgets of all of the cities in the country and all of the states in the country combined, you're looking at a figure of approximately $3.1 trillion. So they would need to take their entire budget for four consecutive years in order to retire the racial wealth gap. And, of course, in the intervening years, they would have no money on which to operate. So that's not a likely scenario. So the federal government is the culpable party, and federal government is the entity that should pay this debt.
Let's talk about for a minute – I know you only have a few more minutes with us. I'm going to try to hold you over into the next hour for about 15 minutes because I think this is very important. And that is how I hear you laughing, Sandy. Yeah, y'all laugh right on. But here is one of the most important things, and I've been talking about reparations on this microphone in this show since 1985. And one of the things that is very disturbing to me is that we do not have not created, now that we have the meat, we've got the beef, you and some others have brought us the beef, and people really understand this whole issue of what I call black poverty crisis. What are we going to do about digging down to the state and local level to educate, organize, and mobilize support for a true reparations debt plan, debt collection program for the descendants of the U.S. system of chattel slavery? How are we going to take what you have created to people at the local level to begin to mount the organizing? Because a lot of education has to go into understanding what's wrong with H.R. 40, what black political elites are pushing it and why, who's trying to dilute and chip away at the issue of national reparations in this country. So the education has to happen. The mobilization has to happen. And we're not doing that in most states and cities across this country. We're not going into the colleges and universities and organizing the support that is necessary for us to, as Ruby Sales would say, press our foot to the metal.
Well, I think originally we were hoping when revelations were made about the role of slavery in the development of a number of our colleges and universities, particularly our most prestigious colleges and universities in the United States, that their response would be to organize, form a coalition that would lobby and petition Congress for a national reparations program. That hasn't happened, but there is always the possibility of their students and alumni joining together to push their institutions to take that type of leadership role in the process of trying to seek reparations at the national level. So what you're really asking me about is something that, you know, Kirsten and I are not real experts at, which is precisely how do you build the social movement? The most that we're able to do is to try to contribute what information and insights we have personally on platforms like yours, to try to get this information out more widely and to encourage people to recognize that reparations is not something that is a fantasy, that it is something that can be made real. And if it's not made real, we will have perpetual racial economic disparity in the United States. So our hope is that there will be others who will take up the mantle from the organizational standpoint so that there can be pressure applied to the United States Congress to adopt a comprehensive national program. And perhaps it is the students at various colleges and universities who could take a strong leadership role in this effort.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was very successful during the Black Power movement era was to have academies in communities with Black high schoolers and college students so that they learn the language of the movement and could be the articulators in organizing and mobilizing, and I don't think that has happened as well. So here you have all of the work that research and the facts. And last week, if I had heard the word Tulsa one more time on TV and radio, I was ready to scream. People were talking about Tulsa and not connecting it specifically to a systemic way in which Black people were terrorized during slavery and Jim Crow. And so I want to be able to say to this audience that the time has come that individuals begin to have neighborhood meetings. We need to be going to Greek organizations. We need to be going to churches. We need to be going to tenant organizations. We need to be on the platforms, on the trains, and everywhere else we can with both teaching and educating. Oh, in the pandemic, I don't think I've seen a barbershop. I have even forgotten about hair salons. But we need to be on the corners with academies, teaching people how to articulate this demand. And we haven't done that yet. And I think we need to have major conferences with the Democratic Socialists of America and the Communists of America and everybody else assisting us in that effort to get people, just as we, just as Randall Robinson was able to get this entire nation to raise their wrists, their fists, and say, Free Mandela. We need to be having black people all over this country, everywhere you go, saying reparations now. And that hasn't happened.
I like it.
You agree?
I like it.
Absolutely.
So I'm saying to people, if you're at a university and or college or you work at the Boys and Girls Club, start organizing learning circles so that people can articulate, understand what this is. And for people, you know, just like we say when white folks make racist comments, you just say, you just said something racist. When black folks say, I don't know if I want reparations, you just say, you just said something stupid. We have got to get into that mode because that is how mobilization begins. And, you know, I said to my 19-year-old grandson the other day, who just finished reading your book, From Here to Equality, write a study guide. If you write a study guide, then you can write a flyer, you can write a rap song, you can do anything that you want with the material that is in that book. And organize some high school kids. You know, he tutors at one of the high schools in Boston. Organize those kids and start teaching them about reparations, and we have got to do that. We don't have a radio station on the internet that's called Reparations Now. We need one.
That's a great idea.
That is a great
idea. I love that
idea.
Well,
your
I can give you a radio
station. Yeah, is this going to be?
I can give you a radio
to do that.
I can give you a radio station tomorrow, and you can have it 5 days a week. I got lots of radio stations. And for those of you who are listening, Our Common Ground does sponsor a Facebook page, and the Facebook page is called Reparations.
Okay.
Remembering and repairing. You know, I got so many Facebook pages, it's ridiculous, but it's called Remembering and Repairing the Past. And it's right there on Facebook, and we provide all of this information right there every day. And you can sign up, join it, like it, whatever they do. But
great.
We have got to do something.
We will refer people to that.
Okay, I'll send you a link.
And
I've had
it
since 2009. That
excellent.
Facebook page has been available. And we will do more of it now that we have had with this conversation. But Sandy and Kirsten, let me ask you, how do we employ this demand given the lack of a political infrastructure that we can trust? Now, when I say we can trust, that is my own judgment about how politics are played, whether it's a black face or some white people talking black. So how do we begin to work it so that black people who we have elected to public office begin to understand the basis and the flaws of H.R. 40? Because they're not going to start over again. You know, they're going to be leaning on this. They've got the president now talking about, I don't think he used the word reparations, but he was talking about repairing and healing and blah, blah. But how do we begin to bend the political, black political elite, specifically the Black Congressional Caucus?
Yes.
How do we begin to bend them to our will? Because
I think we have to.
Go ahead.
Well, so I think we have to build the organization that we trust. Mm-hmm. I don't know, mm-hmm. you know, put your energy, you know, I would say, into creating this new thing that, you know, achieves these objectives that are going to, you know, deliver true reparations. I mean, we can spend a lot of time trying to convert people who are, you know, opponents, but I think our energy, our time, our resources would be better spent trying to create an organization that is led by people who we trust.
And also related to that is the question of who we actually do support to elect to Congress.
Precisely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a number of people who probably we should not continue to reelect to Congress. And I think that has to be addressed.
I think it's important to, you know, to seize opportunities to, you know, when they're at the mic, you know, individuals who are in that space, to ask them pointedly where they stand on these issues, and to ask them to parse their responses. And when you see people hedging, or in some cases just outright saying this is not something that's going to happen, or you know, I think it's a great idea, but the timing isn't right, or that's a signal.
Yeah.
And that's a very important signal that we need to pay attention to.
But
calling people to account, I think, is really important.
It's almost like I have fantasies of the ACT UP movement in the 60s on the science and medical access for victims of HIV/AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
That at some point we're going to have to call these people out, and we're going to have to do it in a way in which it is made clear that they no longer enjoy our trust, and that at some point people are going to have to be called saboteurs. And I say that with a great deal of seriousness. And my concern about the black working class, black political infrastructure, and my concern that it does not exist, is really a critical impediment for any reparations plan. And what we've got to stop saying, and I will thump myself on the head for saying it, we cannot tolerate any reparations plan. We have to tolerate a reparations plan that addresses the incursion of white supremacy that has cut us off and put us in a wealth gap that we cannot recover without it.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no self-improvement plan that's going to get us out of this hole.
Mm-hmm.
There's no 200 to $300 billion plan from the President of the United States that's going to close the racial wealth gap of $11.2 trillion.
Well, they don't even build bridges. They're not willing to build bridges for themselves, so I doubt very seriously, unless something drastic happens, that they're going to want to build bridges for black wealth in this country. And And I say that with a great deal of intrepidation, but at the same time, being a realist, looking at where we are. This is not only a moral issue. It is not only a constitutional issue. It is not only an economic issue. It is a political one. We can't go to the Federal Reserve Bank and take the money and punch Yemen in the throat. We're going to have to work.
No, we
another
can't
one
do that.
Of my fantasies.
I mean, she's a friend of mine. I don't think I want to punch her.
I know. I know. But they're not going to give it up easily, folks. This is not something that will happen easily. And we can't become impatient, and we have to stay on a realistic time frame around this. Now, Sandy, help me out here, because I've been waiting for reparations ever since I left Gary, went back to Boston, and that's all I could think about, that there are people who are really invested in understanding where we are as it relates to where we've been. So give us some kind of timeline. How much time do I have to develop some of these academies?
You know, I'm an economist, and so I'm horrible at forecasting. but I will say this. I think this is a more propitious moment for moving forward on this front than any I've seen in my lifetime. So even though there's a reservoir of about 30% of Americans who I think will never change their perspective on this issue, I think that there's another 70% of the American population that would be open, at least open to beginning to consider reparations as a serious idea. And as we said, there's been a sea change in the proportion of whites who actually support reparations.
Okay, and also younger Americans have been almost overwhelmingly supportive of the idea of reparations, and that's extremely encouraging.
Yeah, that is encouraging.
It
will be essential to change who's in Congress. I mean, the current Congress is not going to pass a comprehensive national reparations plan. So I can't really say, Janice, whether this will happen within the next few years or it will take longer than that. But I do encourage people to be patient, as you said, because if we settle for low-hanging fruit that is less than the whole package, we will never get the whole package.
Yes. We cannot afford to settle. We have one shot at this. One shot.
Yeah. Yes, if we had a minute.
You got 30 more minutes.
we would like to discuss one last thing, and that is how in the last 2 months HR 40 has been revised. I'm not sure that your listeners are aware of what happened, how it was transformed during the recent markup session.
For the worst.
Yeah, that's the dilution.
Right. So, originally the commission, when John Conyers first introduced H.R. 40 in 1989, it provided it proposed a seven-member commission. That number ballooned to 13 in 2015, and now it's 15 commission members. Interesting. The Deputies American Redress Commission began at 7 and ultimately had 9 total members who served. Another change is that they increased the budget for the commission. So originally it was $8 million, then it changed to 12, and now it's $20 million. The salaries for the commissioners can be up to executive level 4, which is $172,000 a year, and they've extended the length of time that the commission could do its work by about half, so a longer period of time to earn that that salary. And it's interesting because the majority of commissions, over 75% of commissions, don't receive salary at all. You know, certainly they, mm-hmm. these individuals are reimbursed for their expenses, their travel expenses, and their administrative staff, you know, the operational staff, absolutely is salaried, but the commissioners themselves are not paid. And for us, you know, we view this as a sacred mission, and we don't believe that these individuals should be paid. And, you know, they are not doing the research. I mean, their job is
yeah.
to mm-hmm. review all the materials that, you know, research teams produce. And, you know, presumably, you know, that would not preclude one from continuing in one's present employment. So we don't really understand what's going on with these salaries. They also changed the legislation within the last 2 months to indicate that no government officials and no government employees may serve as commissioners. So no mayors, no governors, no cabinet members, no members of the House or the Senate may serve. This is very unusual. you know, again, I point to the case with the Japanese American Redress Commission had two sitting members of the House and two sitting members of the Senate who served. And, you know, when you have government officials on a commission like this, it dramatically increases the likelihood that there's going to be integrity and credibility. I mean, these are individuals who, you know, have responsibilities to the public. But this commission, you know, the writers of this commission have, this legislation have deemed that that is not a priority. They also have requested exclusion from the Federal Advisory Commission Act, and this was created to make certain that commissions operate in the light of day. So, you know, the act itself focuses on things like public involvement, public hearings,
mm-hmm.
you know, posting in a public space the meeting dates and agendas, making the transcripts, the notes, the minutes available to the public. This commission now, as written, is excluded from all of those public, you know, awareness
mm-hmm.
you know, requirements.
Mm-hmm.
A quorum is established as 7 of 15, so not even a majority. That's odd. Not a majority, not a supermajority, but 7. So less than half. And then the director for the commission will be an administrative post. So this is someone who is not part of the commission. But that individual has been given the authority to identify 6 of the commissioners. So the president picks 3. The president pro tempore picks 3. Speaker of the House picks 3. And this director picks 6. So, you know, if something comes up and the director, you know, he or she has the support of the 6 commissioners that he or she selects, all they would need is one other person to basically run the table.
To be present.
To be, you know, to be
yeah.
present, to be present and,
mm-hmm.
and conduct
mm-hmm.
business, which we think is really, really bizarre.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like, what exactly is going on here? And it's just not really clear to us. Like,
Kirsten, when you say they changed, who is they?
So these are the changes that were made during the markup session that occurred
okay.
2 months ago. You know, I don't know the specific individuals. I mean, oftentimes it's lobbyists,
uh-huh.
you know, who are writing this legislation. We do know that 2 organizations, Narkin and COBRA, were involved with the writing of the original H.R. 40. You know,
and they revised it
in 2015,
between 2015, 2016, and 2017, 2018.
And you know, it makes a lot of sense that they were involved in these most recent changes, but we don't have direct evidence.
Well, Ron Daniels is going to be with us at the end of the month, to talk about.
You should put these questions to him.
That is okay.
I will put the questions to them,
and I'll also do some research about this, because here, once again, folks, we are victimized by gerrymandering, and now we're victimized by jerry-rigging. Jesus Christ. People do not understand, if people do not understand that there are very many competent and ethical people who work in our government, and they are under obligation to ensure that they do not participate in any process where unethical behavior is operable. And this is real concerning to me. The other is that we have just been plagued over the last 25 years by programs that have been built by people who do not understand how government works. And so the mechanisms here, when you say, when you outline these things, Kirsten, these changes, you're really looking at a group that could clearly come up with the biggest train wreck, and it will become another point of both divisiveness and controversy and conflict that can derail everything. That's incredible.
You have to wonder. I mean, the changes that were made in the markup session are such that, you know, you make the legislation, an easy target for opponents to say, this is not how this should be done. It looks kind of opportunistic, you know, for the people who believe they're going to be serving on the commission. It'd be one thing if the changes had to do with, making certain that reparations are going to be paid to Black Americans in U.S. slavery. But all the changes in the markup had to do with, you know, changing the way the commission itself operates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we certainly will be
deeply problematic.
Yeah, we'll certainly here be visiting what is happening. I was aware about who was how people were being nominated on the commission, but I wasn't aware about the other changes. It's really problematic, and when we talk to NARC and Ron Daniels and whoever's coming at us from Encobra, we certainly will raise those issues. Sandy Darity.
Yeah, I think one of the central issues, before we go, one of the central issues that I think needs to be raised is the question of their advocacy of something that they call a National Reparations Trust Authority that will manage the funds, rather than having the funds be completely a matter of the discretion of the individual eligible recipients. And
wow.
They do not elaborate about who will be responsible for handling this trust authority and handling the money. And that's something that I would love to hear an elaboration on from them.
Hmm. Well, it's
interesting, you know, because NARC and Encobra have the word reparations in their names, a lot of Black people who are, you know, people who are aware of them think, oh, you know, these are the good guys. But they have not done their homework and look to see what, you know, what these organizations are proposing as reparations.
All they have to do is go back and look at the history of Encobra from 1980 to 1983, and look at how that organization was essentially decimated by the politics and control issues going on and divisiveness going on there, which is when I stopped being a member of Vancouver. we have to begin to get everybody involved here, that this is around, that this has to be some grassroots management and control and education and direction in whatever we do, whatever, however we are directing our efforts to get the debt paid. Dr. William Sandy Darity and Kirsten Mullen, the co-authors, and you, I just have to say this, and Sandy, you owe me $50. you know you owe me $50. I want my check. I do have to say that from here to equality, reparations for Black Americans in the 21st century, if you have not read it, if it is not part of your library, you can go to Our Common Ground and I can direct you as to how to get the book. I can, on my website, I provide, somebody that was so kind to put up the first 45 pages or something like that. And you can read it for free for 45 pages. But it is the preeminent.
Don't do that.
No, no, it's a website. It's a website that, that offers it. I'll tell you who it is. Google.com provides 45 pages of your book for free. But
Oh, we didn't know that.
But this is where you start if you have not started. This is where you start. Sandy and Kirsten, I look forward to having you both back. I know that you've had a tough day. You are everywhere, and I am so glad that you are everywhere. You have given reparations and the Black wealth gap and Black inequities a face. And I am so grateful as a citizen, as a Black citizen, for it. So thank you so very much for being with us. And
thank you, Jesus.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it.
This is just has been a great, great conversation that we need to continue to have. We're going to be here for the next 3 weeks going forward, talking about reparations, the debt that is owed. You can stop in, you can call in at any time, send me a note and say, hey, I have some more to say. And you are most welcome. Sandy Darity
so
has
much.
Been an Our Common Ground voice since 2009. And we are so appreciative to be able to have his expertise, his genius, and his spirit. Sandy, are you still playing harmonica?
I am still playing harmonica. That's why I appreciated the blues interlude that you provided.
You know, most people do not know two things, that your father was a prominent scholar and professor, and that Kirsten Mullen is your wife.
Both are true.
Yep. Most people didn't know that. I mean, I've known you since 2009. I knew of you. I heard of you after I left Sloan. And by the way, I'm having my 48th anniversary luncheon sometime in September or something like that. Does your class have a luncheon, an annual luncheon? Maybe because it's too big.
Oh, you mean for my undergraduate school?
No, for Sloan. Weren't you at Sloan? At MIT?
I was not a Sloan Fellow. I was not a Sloan Fellow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
at Sloan, our class is due in the 70s.
I was
a so
Danforth Fellow, and I'm not even sure that program still exists.
Okay. Well, my class, which is the class of 1973, we have a luncheon every year. We had a digital luncheon, a Zoom luncheon last year, but we are getting together for our 48th anniversary, which May 18th would have been our class day or whatever. So thank you so very much. We've enjoyed this conversation. We're coming back at you both to continue it in the future.
Great.
Right.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Take care. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
You too.
Bye.
Wow. I love exchanging harmonica blues with Sandy Darity, but it's just so important to look at what these two people have done in raising the issue of reparations in this country prior to the publication of the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. When we had discourse about the black poverty crisis in America, we had no meat, no factual information in which to build the case. And this book takes us confronting racism and discrimination and how it has choked economic opportunity for blacks at nearly every turn, and the book confronts the injustices head on and makes the most comprehensive case to date for economic reparations for U.S. descendants of chattel slavery, and perhaps one day the debt will be paid. You're listening to Our Common Ground, and in the time that we have left, we'll be talking with you more about the debt that is owed. We'll be right back.
I would like people to pay close attention not only to what happened in Tulsa in 1921, but the entire wave of white massacres that took place from the end of the Civil War up until World War II. These massacres not only cost black people their lives, but also resulted in extensive damage to black property or the appropriation of that property by whites. I think people need to have a much better understanding of the history of white violence in the United States and how that's connected to the racial wealth gap. But if we're going to address the question of restitution for black Americans for the cumulative effects of slavery, the period of Jim Crow or legal segregation in the United States accompanied by white terror campaigns, and ongoing atrocities like mass incarceration, police executions of unarmed blacks, discrimination in labor markets, in credit markets, in housing markets, then we need something that is going to focus on the racial wealth gap, which, to my way of thinking, captures the cumulative intergenerational consequences of this entire trajectory of harms. The GI Bill is established in such a way after World War II that it's administered in a decentralized fashion, which gave Southern authorities complete discretion over who would get the benefits. So, for example, in the state of Mississippi, only two GIs who were black veterans received any mortgage support from the GI Bill. book that I've just completed with Kirsten Mullen, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, we argue that the payments might be made in the form of endowments or a trust account, where individuals would be allowed to spend the interest off the account in any given year, but could only dip into the principal subject to approval for a plan of action or a proposal that they develop.
You're listening to Our Common Ground with Janice Graham. Stay tuned and we'll be right back with more.
Wake up the entire African American community to the hidden issue of mental health.
It showed up in my life through one of my best friends, and we've been friends for over 30 years.
One story at a time.
If we would have known earlier, you know, we would have been much more supportive with her.
Once I reached out to my sister, it got a little better. Once I told my mother, it got a little better. The more I talked about it, I felt it coming off.
The healing is in me, and the healing in a journey can also be extended to others.
It's our community and our mental health.
Giving voice to what you're feeling is part of the healing.
If you're strong enough to just open your mouth, that's all it takes.
And the most revolutionary and healing thing that Black people can do right now is to love one another.
It's time to share ourselves. Healing starts with us. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and the state.
I'm all about that bass, about that bass.
Obama says, we're not going to have boots on the ground, but now you got over 1,000 soldiers. You know why there's going to be more? Because they're going to start killing some of those that we've already pulled there now. Because exactly. If you can't get 30,000 Shiites to stand their ground and they're fully armed against 1,000 Sunni, and they drop their weapons, drop their uniforms, drop their draws and run. What have you got?
Because you know I'm all about that bass, about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, about that bass.
The Alpha Show.
The Alpha Show. Fridays, 10 p.m. Just damn. Advanced political pushback talk radio on TruthWorks Network.
Free Friday. He's all about politics. 10 p.m. TruthWorks Network.
You're listening to Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves, broadcasting bold, brave, black. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you.
Join us each Saturday, 10 p.m.
A program note for your interest. In the month of June 2021, Our Common Ground will host a series of discussion on the issue of reparations for descendants of the American chattel slavery system. Joining us will be Dr. William Sandy Darity, Dr. Derek Hamilton, Dr. Ron Daniels in COBRA, and additionally, we'll be examining the activities related H.R. 40 and the Congressional Black Caucus. We hope you'll join us.
Look at her.
So to the extent that we can anticipate that there might be some sort of backlash among the minority of Americans who remain opposed to reparations that could result in violent outbreaks, it would be necessary to be prepared for that eventuality. And it might be essential to have the National Guard and the military on notice to be prepared to take action against any types of violent outbreaks that are conducted by white terrorists.
Thank you for joining us at Our Common Ground with Janice Graham, transforming truth to power, one broadcast at a time.
And we thank you for being here with us at Our Common Ground tonight in the first episode of our series, Reparations, the Debt That Is Owed. Next week, coming up in the second episode, will be Dr. James Taylor, who is now the chair of the Reparations Commission for the City of San Francisco. And we think that you will enjoy hearing what he has to say about how reparations are being discussed at the city level. Our number is 347-838-9852. So that we are clear, let's go back and review what A. Kirsten Mullen, the co-author of the book that I highly recommend, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. I am on my, I think, fourth reading of this book because I think we have to really understand what the nuances here as we make this demand.
Reparations are a program of acknowledgement, redress, and closure for grievous injustice. Where African Americans are concerned, the grievous injustices that make the case for reparations include slavery, legal segregation, or Jim Crow, and ongoing discrimination and stigmatization. ARC, A-R-C, the acronym that stands for Acknowledgement, Redress, and Closure, characterizes the three essential elements of the reparations program that we are advocating. Acknowledgement, redress, and closure are components of an effective reparations project. Acknowledgement involves recognition and admission of the wrong by the perpetrators or the beneficiaries of the injustice. For African Americans, this means the receipt of a formal apology and a commitment for redress on the part of the American people as a whole, a national act of declaration that a great wrong has been committed. But beyond an apology, acknowledgement requires those who benefited from the exercise of the atrocities to recognize the advantages they gained and commit themselves to the cause of redress. Redress potentially can take two forms, not necessarily mutually exclusive, restitution or atonement. Restitution is the restoration of survivors to their condition before the injustice occurred or to a condition they might have attained had the injustice not taken place. Of course, it's impossible to restore those who were enslaved to a condition preceding their enslavement, not only because those who were enslaved are now deceased, but also because many thousands were born into slavery. But it is possible to move their descendants toward a more equitable position commensurate with the status they would have attained in the absence of the injustices. Atonement, as an alternative form of redress, occurs when perpetrators or beneficiaries meet conditions of forgiveness that are acceptable to the victim. Achieving these elements of a reparations program requires good faith negotiations between those who were wronged and the wrongdoers. There is no existing mechanism for establishing when African Americans collectively will have reached an agreement that sufficient steps have been taken to justify forgiveness. Consequently, atonement is difficult to accomplish. That is why in our proposal, we treat restitution as the appropriate form of redress. We have clear metrics for determining when restitution has been achieved that we do not have for establishing the same for atonement. Specifically, restitution for African Americans would eliminate racial disparities in wealth, income, education, health, sentencing, and incarceration, political participation, and subsequent opportunities to engage in American political and social life. It will require not only an endeavor to compensate for past repression and exploitation, but also an endeavor to offset stubborn existing obstacles to full Black participation in American political and social life. reparations demonstrably would be effective if an improved position for Blacks is associated with sharp and enduring reductions in racial disparities, particularly economic disparities like racial wealth inequality, and corresponding sharp and enduring improvements in Black well-being. Closure involves mutual reconciliation between African Americans and the beneficiaries of slavery, legal segregation, and ongoing discrimination towards Blacks. Whites and Blacks have come to terms over the past, confront the present, and unite to create a new and transformed United States of America. Once the reparations program is executed and racial inequality eliminated, African Americans would make no further claims for race-specific policies on their behalf from the American government on the assumption that no new race-specific injustices are inflicted upon them.
So before I...
Hello. I keep getting muted and unmuted.
Thank you for joining us at Our Common Ground with Janice Graham, transforming truth to power, one broadcast at a time.
A conversation with a description of what we mean by reparations. Reparations are a program of acknowledgement, redress, and closure for grievous injustice. Where African Americans are concerned, the grievous injustices that make the case for reparations include slavery, legal segregation, or Jim Crow, and ongoing discrimination and stigmatization. ARC, A-R-C, the acronym that stands for Acknowledgement, Redress, and Closure, characterizes the three essential elements of the reparations program that we are advocating. Acknowledgement, redress, and closure are components of an effective reparations project. Acknowledgement involves recognition and admission of the wrong by the perpetrators or the beneficiaries of the injustice. For African Americans, this means the receipt of a formal apology and a commitment for redress on the part of the American people as a whole, a national act of declaration that a great wrong has been committed. But beyond an apology, acknowledgement requires those who benefited from the exercise of the atrocity to recognize the advantages they gained and commit themselves to the cause of redress. Redress potentially can take two forms, not necessarily mutually exclusive: restitution or atonement. Restitution is the restoration of survivors to their condition before the injustice occurred, or to a condition they might have attained had the injustice not taken place. Of course, it's impossible to restore those who were enslaved to a condition preceding their enslavement, not only because those who were enslaved are now deceased, but also because many thousands were born into slavery. But it is possible to move their descendants toward a more equitable position commensurate with the status they would have attained in the absence of the injustices. Atonement, as an alternative form of redress, occurs when perpetrators or beneficiaries meet conditions of forgiveness that are acceptable to the victim. Achieving these elements of a reparations program requires good faith negotiations between those who were wronged and the wrongdoers. There is no existing mechanism for establishing when African Americans collectively will have reached an agreement that sufficient steps have been taken to justify forgiveness. Consequently, atonement is difficult to accomplish. That is why in our proposal, we treat restitution as the appropriate form of redress. We have clear metrics for determining when restitution has been achieved that we do not have for establishing the same for atonement. Specifically, restitution for African Americans would eliminate racial disparities in wealth, income, education, health, sentencing, and incarceration, political participation, and subsequent opportunities to engage in American political and social life. It will require not only an endeavor to compensate for past repression and exploitation, but also an endeavor to offset stubborn existing obstacles to full Black participation in American political and social life. Reparations demonstrably would be effective if an improved position for Blacks is associated with sharp and enduring reductions in racial disparities, particularly economic disparities like racial wealth inequality, and corresponding sharp and enduring improvements in Black well-being. Closure involves mutual reconciliation between African Americans and the beneficiaries of slavery, legal segregation, and ongoing discrimination towards Blacks. Whites and Blacks have come to terms over the past, confront the present, and unite to create a new and transformed United States of America. Once the reparations program is executed and racial inequality eliminated, African Americans would make no further claims for race-specific policies on their behalf from the American government on the assumption that no new race-specific injustices are inflicted upon them.
That even as we grieved, we grew. That even as we hurt, we hoped. That even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat. It's the past we step into and how we repair it.
Thank you for joining us tonight at Our Common Ground. Join us each Saturday night, 10 p.m., transforming truth to power, one broadcast at a time. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you, reminding you to trust your struggle.